April 12th, 2022. I just throw up a bunch of noise so that people know we're going to get started, helps you get situated. Now, there is an entire conflict happening in the Donbas, in case you're just joining planet Earth for the first time. If you were born yesterday, to those born yesterday, there's a war in Ukraine. And in this episode, there has been, and there continue to be, between 50 and 70,000 Ukrainian troops. And when we look at a map, you know, their locations, there are maps out there I don't spend a lot of time looking at that lay out precise locations, but they're not, you know, you can tell where they are from where the shelling is, and there's different war nerds that follow the precise locations of these things. That kind of makes it a spectator sport. It's a little bit like any sporting event where you're looking at things from that angle. Now, people have been leaving Kharkov for some time. And I've gotten a lot of different mixed reports about the status of it. So I was hoping to get clarification from the ground, or from what the sense is. And unfortunately, I'm not able to spend a lot of time hunting for it. But I know that South Front ran a disturbing article from April 7th, which isn't that long ago. Feels like an infinite number of days ago, of course, within the context of a conflict where every day is like a week. But when you look at what the mayor was saying on April 7th, the mayor of Kharkov addressed the population to deny reports that he had called, I think that's the clarification, that he had called for a mass evacuation of civilians from the city. But the information reads to deny reports about any mass evacuation of civilians from the city. So there was a video, he came out and he was like on local media, and it was circulated in social media. And he said, quote, "Today the media reported that the Kharkiv region is preparing for evacuation. I want to clarify this concerns only the Lozovsky and Bartankovsky districts of the Kharkiv region." So he's talking about the region where our military is expecting an aggravation of the military situation. So I don't know if that's, you know, you would have to look at a map to see if those are like suburbs of the Kharkov military civil administration area, or if those are, you know, other in the general, you know, county, as it were, or what, if that's the same thing. Now, from a strategic position, there's a lot of advantage. If you're going to be dug in, there's a lot of advantages to being dug in to a city. Now, there isn't much for them to trade in terms of mobility, because there's been all of these strikes on their on Ukraine's fuel storage and refineries, and it's questionable to what extent they're just all in And there's other problems. Now, I listened to parts of the last Scott Ritter interview, which was conducted by Gonzalo Lira, who's there in Kharkov. So if he's able to pop in, I've messaged him privately, but I know he has his morning business to tend to, and there's no expectation or anticipation that he will jump on, but the invitation is there if he sees it. But we will try to figure this out. Now, people from his channel have said that, and you know, if this is wrong, correct it in the open comments. But people from his channel seem to think that he has said or relate that he has said that there's like only 5% of the city remaining. And that's really the that's the problem. Now, it's still advantageous to occupy a city, and I don't know, I mean, if they're just out in the field, outside of, or just the little settlements, you know, that's a different picture. We would like to see that. We would like to figure out where they are, because the mayor, and this is propaganda, of course, but the mayor says that he assured residents left in the city that Kharkov, I say Kharkov, Kharkov is ready to fight. Thus, the armed forces of Ukraine expect that the battle for Kharkov may break out in the nearest future. A large number of Russian troops from the Kiev region have been transferred to the Kharkov front lines. The mayor said that the fact that the city is armed and ready to meet enemy forces on the streets confirms that there is no need for any centralized evacuation. I think that means official planned evacuation. But we keep hearing that people have left. And we want to know to what extent people have left. Now, just from the point of view of the tactics that we've seen, we saw very interesting things in Mariupol. And bear in mind that when you're talking about the Russian advisors and Wagner groups who were with the Syrian Arab Army and the Iranian special forces, when they were dealing with situations like Aleppo, where you have a mixed population, but the occupying army, while they simultaneously see themselves as the legitimate authority, they have an ideology, like an ISIS-type ideology, where their commitment to the people is an abstracted, ethereal, removed from the actual people that are there sort of commitment, if that makes sense. Their commitment is to the future of those people, not to the lives and well-being of the physical human beings who are actually there. You know, those people might be seen as cowards or expendable or problem people. I always refer to the 2004 electoral map. And it tells you a lot. If you want to take a second to whip out your search engine and look for the 2004 Ukrainian election, now would be a good time to do that. Because what you'll see is that in that election, Yanukovych got a very large part of the vote in the Kharkov region, which means he got like 70%, which means that the Ukrainian forces are viewed probably at this point in time as well, and especially in context of the Maidan and the increase of hyperbolic Nazi anti-Russian rhetoric that has increased over the past 15 years, that and the Ukrainian forces have a sense that they are actually the occupiers, and they're treating the people as a people that need to be corrected. It's a lot like living in Los Angeles and all the police being Anglo-Saxons from Simi Valley. Imagine if you were in Belgrade and all the police were Croatians. That would be a pretty fucked up situation. And that's a lot like the situation that you have in Kharkov. And that changes a lot of the metric, because I listened to Scott Ritter on Gonzalo Lira's YouTube live stream the other day. And I tuned in and out. I unfortunately spend most of the time looking at textual material from sources, and the rate of information absorption from audio does not allow me to in turn produce audio material for you. So I tuned in and out. But from the things that I gathered, there were some assumptions that stood out to me. And one of those assumptions was that the Ukrainian forces would be rational. And I don't believe that that is the case. Now, they can run out of food and have real situations. But in terms of having concerns about the loss of human life in a region where their state media has said that the people of this region are excess people, that they could depopulate the region, frankly. They could ethnically cleanse the region and they would be better off. That is what has been promoted in the mainstream media out of Kiev. So that really changes their consideration that they would be honorable, that they would serve with any level of distinction or any, you know, any of the normal senses that they are defending their people. That all of those concepts were tied up in Mr. Ritter's rubric in explaining why he did not think that a military incursion of or a siege or a taking of Kharkov would be necessary. Maybe a siege, but then that ties you down. I think they may have mentioned that. And if you have 50 to 70,000 of these Ukrainians in the somewhere in that area, whether it's maybe they're in outside of Poltava, a little bit in the adjacent oblast. They would have better support there. That was definitely more leaning. It's on the Dnieper River. But in that region, is close to Kharkov. I don't know if the troops are tied down in the Kharkov region or in. It's they're sort of like a tri oblast region there. And if anyone knows exactly where they are right now, please do comment, and I'll look to see what you're saying. I'll look to see what that is. But if there really isn't an understanding of it, then we can only guesstimate. I know there are like the live UA map, and there are different sort of war nerd and generic war gonzo, not the war gonzo, but you know what used to be called war nerds and war gonzo type maps that would show where the things are. And of course, right now there is a aerial, you know, air sirens going off as we speak in Kharkov, but same in Odessa. And when you look at the map, you can see that they are saying that as of, you know, updated 2 minutes ago, but then the time is forward. I'm an hour behind Ukraine time. They're just one time zone over for me. There are these areas that are being hit, so we can assume that from the location of these reported strikes, you know, no, it would be wrong to actually assume, because these could be being reported by the Ukrainian side, which are going to report that Russians are striking villages, which is supposed to increase the spectacle of war crime. So that's why I think a lot of these maps that track the action can be critically flawed, because they could serve a propaganda mechanism in the sense of being misleading. There's like a settlement, like a neighborhood, looks like it's just a few blocks big, called Severodonetsk. I guess that's like North Donetsk. There's Novodruzhek, which is like New Druzhesk. But it's unclear if they are more like in the fields outside, where, you know, where they are dug in, and to what extent they are actually in, you know, that's in the areas sort of like in this forming cauldron in the Donetsk region that we're talking about. Actually in, Lugansk region. So the fight is definitely for Kharkov, but it's unclear to what extent the Ukrainian forces would go, are in Kharkov or would go into Kharkov, because it just seems that from the doctrines that being used, that, you know, Scott Ritter is saying that they had gone gopher and that they had dug in trenches and these little, you know, there are these British type of pill boxes, kind of like I don't know if they're metal or concrete, but you can dig in and kind of, you dig into the earth and you plant these things in there and you can have these people, you know, you can put people in there. But I, you know, when you look at how Mariupol went down and how they were able to concentrate forces in there, they had something like, well, it looked like at first they had 15 to 18,000 holding Mariupol, and the doctrine would be that it would take, you know, four times as many, so like 60, 70,000 Russian soldiers to take Mariupol, and you would expect like a casualty rate just for that theater during that limited period, not an overall throughout the whole conflict, like for one person who was, you know, who moved from battle to battle, but for the army in that battle, you know, you would have a casualty rate maybe of 10 to 20%, 15%. That's not deaths, but, you know, all injuries that would remove you at least to triage. So, but in fact, what we saw was, and this is why I mentioned Aleppo, okay? And this is why I talked about hostages and terrorism. Because the national battalions, the so-called volunteer battalions that were supposed to be integrated into the army, but they're just, that's just how they, that's just the reporting, the so-called reporting structures. On the one hand, it's more dangerous because these reporting structures have fallen apart. So that means that, or at least Kiev is seeming to play a game in between we are in control and we're not allowing people to surrender, and or these armies in the field, we can no longer get good information to them. There was a situation 2 weeks ago where Zelensky goes on TV and he declares that two of the field generals who are also SBU officers had been terminated for treason. And one of the thoughts that had occurred to me was that they actually couldn't get orders to them, or those field commanders couldn't actually interpret or understand if orders they were getting were actually from Kiev, from Central Command, or if they were fake orders. And they probably decided that if the orders didn't make sense or didn't seem like they followed their training and the doctrine and the strategy that as they understood the conflict, that those orders might have been fake. And then maybe they didn't take those orders, or maybe the orders were to do something that they thought would have paralyzed their force. Maybe it was something that they would have had to lose a third of their force just to do. And they didn't want to do that. Or maybe they were cannibalizing each other at this point already for certain things. We don't know. But we do know that Zelensky went on TV to fire them, which didn't seem to me to be a propaganda stunt that he's showing strength. It seemed to me to be, because he names them, it seemed to me to be basically calling for a hit on them or saying that they're fired, because he doesn't actually have the chain of command channels to communicate that through a, you know, wire or through their encrypted methods, their radio, their channels, whatever, radio, digital radio, we just call it radio, but they have, you know, digital communications, that wouldn't have gone through. So it's curious to what extent this army in the field is operating autonomously. We're talking about 50 to 70,000 if they're operating autonomously. So I'm going to now let's see if Gonzo will talk to us. Let's see if he's able. We don't know. I will, let me see if I can find the link. We'll wait. Yes. Great. Okay. Let's see if I can get this link over to him. Where is the link for it? That's what I want to know. I think that's it. Yes. I think I gave him the link. So let's see if he pops in. Oh, I see. He asked a question. I thought he might talk to us live. I didn't see. Let me look in the comments. Just a moment. I'm having a difficulty, you know, navigating between he's asking what my thoughts are over the recent recommendation, and I don't know what recommendation that refers to, and I'm having a difficulty finding, you know, where else he may have communicated his question. So if anyone sees it, it's hard for me to, I don't walk and chew gum at the same time, and it's hard for me to maintain the necessary flow of a live stream and also scroll upwards and find or catch where Mr. Lira may have given a question or a comment, but I was hoping that okay, he says he'll talk to us, but I don't see, seems that he should be in the audience and then wave his hand and then jump on and then tell us what he thinks is going on and how he sees the situation. And I want to apologize if he looks like he asked a question. I didn't see it. So we will see if we're able to communicate. Now, so the thing is that, so yeah, there was some assumptions that Ritter, and it makes sense within the context of normal, you know, warfare. What I wanted to say was that, how Mariupol was done, you know, it looked like there were 3,000 more Ukrainian forces, you know, whatever, combined. It looks like they pressed the Marines, the regular Ukrainian military Marines into Azov. That's what we recall from reports and what we saw happening. But so they looks like they had 20 to 25,000 Russians to take Mariupol, with a force in Mariupol of some like 15 to 20,000. So almost even. It was like five Russians for every four, six Russians for every five Ukrainians. And that is a very unusual number. Normally you're looking at 4 to 1 to take a city because of, you know, buildings and how you can dig in and the advantages that you have. But we haven't really seen how this type of urban warfare works with things like drones and different technologies and different doctrines that have evolved from the conflict in Syria and the advisors, the Russian advisors in Syria that that had, you know, were trying to rebuild, basically to help rebuild a broken Syrian Arab army and take these towns and cities from whether it was like ISIS or TFSA. And that led to revising, learning how to use armor and tanks in ways that are very different from how they had been used in a very ill-advised way in the past. For example, the U.S. in Vietnam initially attempted to use a lot of tanks. And, you know, you had General Westmoreland and trying to use tanks with the thinking that this is an advantage because the Vietnamese don't have tanks and we do have tanks. And so that has to be good. And, but the necessary, you need really a lot of, infantry to spread out around the tanks are very vulnerable in urban fighting to being hit with, anti-tank handheld devices out of windows and popping up out of sewers and who knows what. And you have really urban tactics, which kind of resemble guerrilla tactics, small group fighting, like what you would call platoons in the American arrangement, a platoon. And you might just have like a dozen people in a unit in urban fighting, you know, moving around. And then you multiply that dozen by, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of teams, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of teams like that. In urban fighting on a single side. So Mariupol by traditional doctrines would have required some like 60,000 to take. And from credible reports that I've read, they did this with just maybe 10% more than the defending side through the use of drones, certain ways of using weapons and strategic operations on the ground, and the use of tanks at great distance. Not bringing the tank into the heat of the front, but using them at a distance as kind of like a mobile artillery. Because now these tanks have electronically assisted guidance and aiming systems. And I, you know, and so understanding that, however, it's very, very strange. It's very, very strange because it does perhaps seem like it could lend credence to some notion that the Russians might have thought they could do something with 50,000 in Kiev. But I just don't believe that that's in fact the case. But understanding that this is the Russian doctrine, that you can take a city with just maybe 10 or 15% more than the defending force while having hostages. Because in many ways, in when you're talking about the east of Ukraine, and this is where I questioned Ritter's, and I don't think he's wrong. I just think that you doing an interview, and when you're doing an interview, it's more stream of consciousness, and you're just kind of reviewing, you know, the basic points of how you understand, you know, military best practice and the beliefs and their commitments in very general terms. And he's treating them as a regular army, not as as if they're the defenders and as if they view the people in the East as their people, and that they wouldn't make decisions that would jeopardize the people, right? As if they wouldn't. And what's interesting is that in that interview with Gonzalo, he is saying, oh, well, they have this very, you know, it's these Nazi groups have a very, you know, misanthropic ideology and very hateful and stuff, and they would kill civilians. But I don't, and, but he seems to be separating that from the regular army. And I think that that is an error, not an error. I just think that he was just speaking off the top of his head, stream of consciousness. That's all. Okay. I don't think he's mistaken. I don't think that people can be held to account or be said that they were wrong in a 2-hour interview where they mentioned something. Just to be clear. Okay. Just to be clear. So now, yeah, Gonzalo is very, very busy at the moment. I wanted to get a read of how many people are in Kharkov. Now, that doesn't change. The number of people in Kharkov only changes the Russian ability and the speed at which they would take it. And if the city is evacuated, then they can use tanks firing directly at buildings, and they can use them at a great distance with these electronically guided shots. The T-80 is, even T-72s have been retrofitted with electronic guidance or correction on shots, and you basically have spotters at a distance, and you have drones to guide these. That's in fact why the OSCE was banned, because they're supposed to be a neutral humanitarian group on the ground representing, you know, this collective security actually that Russia was a part of, monitoring, and they were helping to guide Ukrainian shots. As they were acting as spotters. Awful. Awful. You know, people wonder why humanitarian things get attacked ever, or why they don't get attacked. It's just people are playing games with this. It's very dangerous to play games with the Red Cross stuff or the OSCE stuff. But OSCE is banned. The OSCE stuff, they're done. These are the games that are being played in this conflict. So when you look at Kharkov. If we assume that there is any difficulty in wearing down through artillery and aerial of their entrenched positions, it would make more sense that they would go into the city, because there's a general reluctance to flatten the city. But when you look at Mariupol, you can see that the Russians definitely made an example of, once civilians are evacuated, what they're willing to do. It's sort of like Mariupol was an example of what Russia can do, but also what politically, in terms of the EU's response, that Russia can get away with. Because even though every effort was made, and it looks like with very large degree of success, to evacuate the civilians in whole sectors of the city, the infrastructure is destroyed. The buildings are destroyed. What system is there going to be for people? These are apartments. These are people's lives. They probably have a value besides the sentimental value, but they probably have a value of 500 to 700 euros per square meter or more. There's a lot of, most of those apartments are between 45 and 75 square meters. How are people going to rebuild their lives there? Does Russia have a plan for that? Because that is going to be part of a pro-Russian entity. Mariupol is in Donetsk. I want to see literature. I want to see promises. I want to see a program. I want to see that people, you know, show their title from the cadastre, the real estate registration, and that they're 110% market value reimbursed and taken care of, and everything in between. This has to be part of the deal, or there is something very lacking in the justice of the Russian campaign. It was important that they spared human life, of course. But apartments and where people live is what people have worked for their whole lives, and it's what they intend to pass on to their children. That's how it works in this part of the world. So that's the situation. I think that Ritter assumes, conversationally at least, assumes that Ukrainian forces will act a certain way, because even though it's true that the regular Ukrainian army aren't ideological Nazis, all of the commanders are political appointments, are on board, report to effectively the cabal. And the cabal is willing to wage this war down to the very last Ukrainian. And on top of that, they don't view 2/3 or more, but about 2/3 from election results, they don't view 2/3 of people in Kharkov as real Ukrainians. Not by this sort of narrow definition. It was really the Galician that hijacked the Ukrainian identity. the central regions of Ukraine were always more intermixed with Russians, and Russian language was the primary language in Kiev until the language laws happened just 8 years ago. A lot of TV, but just in business and if you work somewhere, people spoke Russian. This is not, it's totally missing the point to think about, oh, the ethnic Russians in the east of the country. That's totally missing the point. Identities are more complex. Yeah, there were people that say we are Russian who live in the Donbass. But all throughout Ukraine, number one, there are Russians. And number two, Russia isn't like one thing. There's many different parts of Russia, and the people are distinct by those regions within what is called the country called Russia, like that has a seat on the UN called Russia, has many regions and parts of the country. The people are as different from each other in mentality as Ukrainians are from, you know, the generic construct of the Russian, which is a false construct. There's many Russias. So there are types of Ukrainians that are simultaneously Ukrainians, not Russians, but simultaneously Ukrainians, but see themselves as part of a bandwidth of Russianness, if that makes sense. And that's different from the actual ethnic Russians in the east of the country, and also who live in smaller numbers throughout the whole country, all the way up to, you know, even near Poland, there are ethnic Russians. It's just they're statistically the numbers drop. But the mentality of regular Ukrainians, it varies a lot. And that's different from the ethnic Galicians that have imposed this Nazi identity onto the rest of the country, a lot through different music scenes and through football clubs. And we talked about this before. Basically, youth subcultures, but then reinforced by official people in state, in power. This goes back before Poroshenko. This was Tymoshenko. This was in the writings of Kuchma, in a sort of soft, we're the victim kind of way. That, like, we talk about his book, Ukraine is Not Russia, and there's a picture of him sitting in a field of dandelions, like he's some hippie or something who just loves peace. And that's where that whole victim ideology comes from. I said a month and a half ago on this channel that the victim mentality that justifies revenge is depicted through the image of a defenseless woman who's been raped and ravaged and now has a justified revenge. That's exactly word for word what came out of my mouth on this live stream. And then we saw precisely that propaganda piece come out, because that encapsulates the narrative, because that's exactly what it is on the psychoanalytic level. That's how this critical race theory works. Now, and I want to say to people on the left who don't understand what I'm saying, because they're like, Joaquin, you're an idiot. Stop making this a Trump thing about critical race theory, because these Ukrainians are Nazis and critical race theory is a, you know, post-Marxist thing based on, you know, the American experience and how, you know, everything from slavery to the Three-Fifths Law to Jim Crow, analyzing how the disproportionate, how, you know, and there's truth in critical race theory. At the original criticism of the criminal justice system in the United States, there were proven instances of, for example, in Chief Daryl Gates of the LAPD and the whole LAPD doctrine on how they made arrests and what kind of evidence they collected for the DA. The only difference in factors between how they prosecuted youth was the color of their skin. And we know that because you can account for class, you can account for priors, for you can account for, delinquency, you can account for all these factors. And when you reduce all these factors down to, comparing apples to apples, race was the remaining factor. And Black kids got longer sentences or even sentences at all. And kids who are white didn't get the same sentence for the same crime, all other factors being equal. So no games about, well, they had priors or whatever. No, the view was that in the 60s and 70s, and even in the 80s, and still, I think, in some parts, and this is just a cold, hard truth that you have to deal with if you don't understand it, is that the view was that white kids were just getting in trouble and they were, boys will be boys and they'll grow out of it. But that with Black kids, the theory was criminality emerges at a young age and you must give them the maximum sentence early on, with the theory that, they become a greater danger later on. This was the whole thing with Joe Biden and the Clintons pursuing that super predator legislation. It's a continuation of that. So critical race theory in the U.S. was a theory about the imbalances and the built-in prejudices in the criminal justice system. And there are truths in there. But how that got expanded and became a whole industry of grifting and fraud and perpetuating divisions is what people are looking at. But then people don't understand what I'm saying about how Nazi ideology in Ukraine is based in critical race theory. We're talking about how that mutated in the U.S. as what justifies the actions of the victims, right? Like what justifies BLM to do terrorism, to burn down cities, Antifa. Actually, it was our revolution. It was coordinated through my former organization, SEIU, the On the Ground campaign. We've talked about that plenty. I have all the these aren't fucking loose notions in my head. I have, Rafael Navarre, political director, SEIU, our revolution, the Bernie Sanders campaign. All the money came from Democracy Action, George Soros, Democratic Party, funneled through this Democracy Action, Vote Blue. This is not some fun jumbled collection of notions in my head because I have an agenda. No. So when you look at Kuchma, was a communist. He was a leading Communist Party member. So that's where you understand within the Marxist framework of the victim ideology, it just fused and went nicely to go in with this Nazi belief, but it positioned their Nazism not from the perspective of a master race. And that's a little bit different than German Nazism, but as the victim who has finally regathered her dignity and has decided to take revenge on her rapists. There are some horror movies, there's like a series of them where this girl gets horribly, like a home invasion while she's on vacation. And then she goes back and picks them off one by one, kind of like Rambo. She sets these booby traps and slits throats and dips people's heads in acid. And you're like rooting for her, right? Because these guys are horrible. When they gang raped her, it was horrible. So that, and that's how you create the ideology of a state as a victim people. Yeah. And because it draws these irrational, it's based in the politics of irrationality or anti-rationality, which is at the heart of also fascist politics. Once you understand that Kuchma was a communist for two thirds of his adult life and, was a Marxist-Leninist, and how his writings became the framework for normalizing this victim mentality that would then be transformed further and develop into a whole Nazi narrative. And what you just saw in that video that was allowed on Facebook because Zuckerberg is going to allow new community standards rules, which allows Ukrainians to call for the killing of Russians. Now, when I said that Zuckerberg, you're going to find that he's going to be directly responsible for the killings of Bucha and other places, I didn't mean that. I meant that they directly inform the SBU on what the social attitudes are of people in Ukraine by their ISP address, by their name, by their WhatsApp account, the things, the type of messages that they sent to each other. Everyone is profiled. SBU has it all, thanks to Mark Zuckerberg. Thanks to Facebook. Thanks to WhatsApp. They have an open door for them. They have the developer app. They don't have to put in a request on a suspect and then Facebook looks, do you have a warrant? The actual SBU is running Facebook in Ukraine. Do you understand how that works with the police integration of Facebook? That's how it works in many countries, in fact. So, how we have the problem of this military. Scott Ritter thinks that they won't do things stupid. And he believes that they are loaded up on munitions and food and are dug in and good to go for a while. He suggests that the Russian advance just bypass Kharkov and that Kharkov will, you know, just by being cut off, eventually fall. And I don't see how that works because the occupying because the Ukrainian army is actually the occupying army. And they don't have, they're not, there's not a sovereign control. It's not like Zelensky is actually in control. He can't, even if he has a change of heart and he wants to go, okay, we'll surrender Kharkov because the army can't feed itself. And now they're cannibalizing the people who live there. Now they're breaking into people's homes and taking cans of food out of their pantries to eat. And now the people, that's not what's going to happen. They're not going to stop because of that. They're just going to loot the people that are there. It will be a humanitarian crisis caused by this occupying Ukrainian force in Kharkov. But within the rubric of so-called international law and how people typically, and not wrongly, but how people typically tend to observe this, you see, Russia actually has the obligation as the technically occupying force to mitigate all of these potential human catastrophes as much as possible, which means that I think they will have to go into Kharkov. At some point soon, they will have to go in. And that's why my question has to do so much with how many people are actually left in the city. It's 1.4 million people, if we haven't been clear. And I should have probably introduced this and asked people, do you guys know what's, you know, it's like the size of Dallas. We're not talking about the village of Kharkov, by the way. This is the second largest city in all of Ukraine. It would be, it's going to be the capital of any sort of Donbas Federation. This is not supposed to be part of Ukraine under any iteration. Only a defeat, only a Russian defeat scenario does this go back to Ukraine. I don't think that there's anywhere that the Russian forces were very active, except for the Kiev and the adjacent region directly immediately east of there, or surrounding it and east of there, that Russia does not intend to stay. I think they absolutely are staying there. You know, Sumy, and Chernihiv or Cherniv are, I don't have a clear picture of what that would look like, except I do know that the majority of voters there tended to vote 2/3 for the anti-Russian candidates like Yushchenko and Tymoshenko in past elections. So the line actually is like Kharkov is the northwestmost state of a breakaway republic. Does that make sense? But there are many people, like 30-40% of the populations of Chernihiv and Sumy, that would like, at this point in time now, because of the Kiev junta, at this point in time, they would rather be part of Russia than not. But they're not the majority. Like, if there was a referendum, that they'd probably lose, you see. The Russian aim is during the occupation. Now, I'm calling it occupation because international law calls it an occupation. And when I call it an occupation, by the way, that's not a bad thing. It's very important to call it an occupation. Okay? It's very important to call it an occupation because the standards, whatever you call it, like a rose is still a rose, you know, still smells as sweet, whatever you call it, the rose is still a rose. An occupation is occupation, and that increases Russia's requirements to the humanitarian angle. Like in international law, the occupying army has a higher standard by which they have to treat the civilians in which they're occupying. There are certain rules, like you can't actually raise your flag. Now, people there can raise flags, and whenever you've seen flags raised in Kharkov or Kherson or any place other than, actually any place at this point, have just been temporary victory flags. They've been for the photo op. Maybe it's been the Chechen flag, maybe, and a Russian flag, whatever. But with Mariupol, they can do it because that is part of the declared boundaries of the Donetsk People's Republic. So Mariupol already is within the state, the independent state of Donetsk, of the Republic. So the Republican forces were treating Azov in Mariupol, even though they're on the Sea of Azov, which they get their namesake from. It's kind of hilarious. So people understand who are just kind of joining this. The Azovstal plant facility wasn't named by the Azov battalion as their base. That was the name of it because the Sea of Azov is there. The battalion is actually named after the sea, not the other way around, just so you understand. But the Republican forces treat them as an insurgent terrorist group. They're actually on the laws of Donetsk because it's been a breakaway republic self-declared for 8 years. So there they have their own intelligence service. They have their own police. Like in the parts of former Ukraine, they already have it, like their own police cars, their own they use rubles. Everyone has Russian passports for since 2016 or 17, 16. And they treat Mariupol and Azov and Mariupol as the occupation, as the occupiers. And the majority of people there, it was 50-50. Now, this is ethnicity, but doesn't tell you how people think. So don't be misled. It used to be 50% ethnic Russians and 50% self-identified Ukrainians. But of that 50% self-identified Ukrainians, you mostly had that type of Ukrainian. And this is what we tried to explain at the top of the hour. That type of Ukrainian that views Ukrainianness as part of an intercompatible bandwidth connected to Russia. It's separate, but it's compatible and friendly with Russia. It's a different, the Ukrainian identity has been hijacked by Galician Nazis that claim a legacy of Cossack groups that they have no fucking historical ethnic relationship with. They claim the legacy of earlier iterations of a Ukrainian state at times in history when those people were called Transcarpathians. They were at different times called Rusinians or Ruthenians. And even those people have separated from each other because the modern Galicians are a mix of Poles who are trying to ethnically cleanse the Poles of which they're mixed with, which gives them the neo-Galician identity. But historically, the people of Galicia before this Nazi thing, or the ones who don't identify as Nazis, continue with the much older name identified as different types of Transcarpathians, mostly as Ruthenians or Rusins. Rusins and Rutens. Okay. I'm just trying to help understand so people understand that the Ukrainian forces, even though the army is drawn from regular people and basically good kids who just didn't have money to buy their way out of the conscription, out of the draft, okay, just basically working class kids, okay? Now, it's true that the football culture encourages the Sieg Heiling, and a lot of them have participated in that. Don't get me wrong either. The big football clubs throughout all of Ukraine have that element to them. But that doesn't mean the kids are misanthropic, okay? Because the low-level veneer of the Nazi ideology, not the misanthropic pagans and Satanists and the weird occult stuff and the cults to murder, the cults of killing and things like that, okay? The mainstream kind of kid, 20 years old, still figuring out how the world works. His older brother, him, are into the football, you know, club, and they do the Sieg Heil stuff. They just think that Nazism was misunderstood. They're not really Nazis. It's just the thing to do, but they just think they don't really have a firm grasp of history. Or if they do, they see it through the Nazi propaganda that was made for the masses, which was actually very pro-social. Although it was very racially exclusive, it wasn't misanthropic. The misanthropic stuff is like the SS and the special divisions and the occult and the esoteric and the death squads. And you have to have training. You have to have desensitization training to be like an ISIS type killer, which many of the Azov and Idar and these people are. But the regular army, even though these kinds of, teenage confused identity sentiments are embedded, they're not going to go kill civilians. Does that make sense, what I'm saying? You really have to understand the lay of the land. And just think about gang culture in the U.S. Very different if you're a convict in a prison gang and if you're just like a 19-year-old kid who's a tagger. You might even claim the same set and you're fronting a little bit, but you'd never shoot anybody. You just listen to hip hop and live in the ghetto. Does that make sense? So you're not a hardened criminal. And so Ritter is not wrong in viewing it, if that's his view, and I suspect that that's what it is, because his general view is that the Ukrainian army is going to act like a normal army that views the people there as their civilians to protect. And I just believe that's wrong. I just believe that that's wrong for reasons I've explained. Not because the regular army guys are trained killers, but because the command structure is not sovereign. It's the cabal, right? It's people who call themselves Americans, but if I'm an American, then they sure as fuck aren't. But they call themselves Americans who are actually running the show in Ukraine, and they will not let them, they will not let Zelensky let them to retreat or to spare civilian lives. So they have raised three armies, battalions, in the Kharkov region. Out of, they've just let three whole battalions worth of men out of prison to supplement this 60 or so thousand force. But their job is to not let civilians leave. And if the civilians leave, then the operation doesn't have to be as surgical. It only, we're talking about taking Kharkov. It only has to be as surgical. There's no negotiating. You understand? It isn't like Imperial Japan and after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you know, Hirohito and Tojo confer and agree that they need to effectively surrender unconditionally because they don't want another Japanese city nuked. That's not the situation in Ukraine at all. The cabal is willing to take this conflict to the very last Ukrainian individual on planet Earth, the very last Ukrainian passport holder living on the terrain of former Ukraine, regardless of ethnicity, whether they're whatever the different, you know, there's like two, three different ways of speaking Ukrainian language, in fact. There's like what the Galicians speak, which is basically like Polish with a Russian accent and a few Russian words. Then there's kind of like Ukrainian, which is basically Russian, but spoken in a funny way. And then there's Russian. It's basically like Russian with these Galician and other Polish kind of words, but it's not as much Polish as Galician is, if that makes sense. And then there's several of those pigeons. Ukrainian is like basically a series of different pigeons that they've tried to make the central language spoken in the central territories of the country be like the what is standard Ukrainian. And there's high degrees of interintelligibility with that and Russian. And people all over mix it in. And the, you know, the who are the comedians and who are the pop stars and the TV shows people get from until more recently, I mean, with the anti-Russian laws, but until, you know, in days recently, like 10 years ago, people had TV and they're piping through Russian TV and Russian comedians and Russian movies, along with, you know, the much lower amount of Ukrainian stuff in terms of Ukrainian language. And by that, we don't mean Galician. So, you know, it's when Ritter said that in some way, like the whole Ukrainian identity is a little bit fake. I mean, and he caught himself. He's actually a man of the left. And he caught himself you know, breaking kind of some left-wing ideas about respecting every people. Maybe they're human ideas, more to the point. So he kind of tried to catch himself there. But just think about it in these terms. The Ukrainian army does not see Kharkov people as like, we have to defend them. That's the problem. Now, and then you have the Russian military doctrines revised, and they're able to take a city. If the population has moved, they're able to take a city and use new tactics involving the use of armor and tanks at a distance as mobile artillery, and greatly shrink that ratio. It was a very high ratio before that you would be required to keep your losses in that operation below, you know, 10 or 15% acceptable. I mean casualties, not deaths. And you probably have 3 casualties or 4 casualties for every 1 death. Like getting your finger blown off or something, like you're taken out of battle. And, you know, if you're not under siege, like if you're going to be rotated out to triage and then thanks for your service most of the time. Unless you're begging to get back into the fight, you know, but let's assume not. And so you have like 4/5 of casualties are non-lethal. And then you have 10% of the soldiers are going to be casualties. And the force that took Mariupol was like 25,000. And the defending force was like 17 to 22,000. I don't know how you fit in the surprise 3,000 that were at Azovstal. So you can see how close the numbers of attackers to defenders were. And still the losses were pretty minimal. Because this is doctrine. This is like what they learned a little bit from Chechnya, but then what they learned from Syria. U.S. advisors do not have this type of experience or training. Because U.S. doctrine has not had concern for human life. And that's just the sad truth about it. U.S. military analysts viewed the opening month of the Russian campaign through the lens of the U.S. approach, which is hostile occupation and obliterate everything in sight. Going into people's homes and beating women, waterboarding people in their living rooms to get information because you suspect that somebody's uncle is the one who planted the IED on the road. So when I look at this South Front article, and the mayor is saying that people should not flee, and that there's no organized effort that the city approves of. So I think they're kind of mincing words a little bit. It's like he's not saying that people haven't left. He's just saying, you know, this is the mayor, Terekov, okay? And he addresses the population like on the 6th or 7th of April. So this is pretty recent. This is not like the middle of March and we're trying to figure out what's going on, right? And he says, we will stand, we will defend our city, we're together. That's disturbing. Now, South Front concludes that the Nazi Kiev regime is, quote, deliberately sacrificing the population of the large cities and smaller villages in the east of the country where the Russian-speaking population lives, largely supporting Russia. That's more correct. That's exactly what we were just saying. That's why I don't think that, I just don't think that, I mean, there's ways to not go head on into Kharkov. And I do think that it would make sense to surround it and to, by attrition, wear down however many of that 60,000 that are in the field, but I'm not sure that the number of people counts as much as their destroyed, how much of their actual artillery, you know, their hardware, their pieces have been destroyed. You know, having 50, 60,000 guys in the field with automatic, semi-automatic rifles, long rifles, I don't think is a concern for a military that has, you know, artillery and tanks and everything. So they're just going to be stuck there. And it just, in my mind, it makes more sense that they would try, if they are dug in into the field, I'm just confused about why they didn't dig into Kharkov in the same way that they dug into Mariupol. Does that make sense what my question is? So that's how I look at this. I just think that they're going to have to take Kharkov. So I don't think that cooler heads prevail or people would. I don't think that the mayor or anything. I mean, maybe it could happen, but there's so many backdoor deals that could happen. So many ways to avoid going into Kharkov. Don't get me wrong. And I do think it's preferable to not go into Kharkov. Again, don't get me wrong. I only mean to say, all right, I only mean to say that if the rationale that Russia doesn't go into Kharkov is because Ukrainian forces aren't going to allow the people to suffer, is just a false understanding of the situation. So that basically is the gist of our analysis of what's going on in the field. I mean, we could talk just about, you know, in brief, some of who's operating there. There has been a change in the deployment of Russian forces there. The first round of deployment was mostly with these sort of meat grinder pieces of hardware and things that they expected to also get damaged. Okay, now near Kharkov, we're seeing a step up from the basic Russian military deployment. Now we're seeing the 4th Tank Division, which consists of some very advanced tanks such as the T-80Us series, the T-80UE1, the T-80BV, as well as these Ka-52s and the Conkers ATGM-equipped BMP-2s. That's what we've seen. There's receipts on this. There's video of these deploying. So this is definitely a step up. And mind you, these T-80s, that series, they've been upgraded. And they have electronic guidance systems on their how they can shoot. and they can shoot kilometers away. So it's not like tank fights in World War II or something like that, where they get up close and personal. These things are firing from great distances, great, great distances. It's a lot like how Air Force is. Like, we don't have dogfights anymore where pilots see the plane. These guys are shooting, you know, when you have air-to-air fighters, they're fighting from kilometers and kilometers away from each other, many kilometers away, 100, 50 kilometers away. And they don't see each other. And likewise, these tanks can shoot from quite, not as far as fighters in the air, but still quite a distance, quite the distance. And they will have drones and helicopters provide guidance and other sort of reconnaissance. And I don't think that there's any realistic chance for this 60,000 group to do anything. You know, that I don't think that casualties on the Russian side will even approach 5% in these activities right now. I think you'll see it about like 3%, you know, one out of 30 guys is gonna get some shrapnel in his knee, or, you know, and then, like we said, only a fraction of those guys is gonna get killed. And I've seen these kinds of, when you think about it in the numbers like this, then when the Russians report, you know, just a few thousand deaths, and that probably doesn't include the Republican forces that probably have taken the same, and then maybe some from South Ossetia, then some from Syria, even, as I understand, and some from the Armenian breakaway, pro-Armenian breakaway, Artsakh, some from there, probably a couple hundred, maybe 200, 100, 100 from each of those, you know, 4,000, 4,500 deaths combined, maybe at this point, 5,000, I would say, 4,000 to 5,000. Now, yeah, I mean, the Pentagon was saying that number, but they were saying that number on March 1st, which is ridiculous. They're saying 20,000, 30,000 now, and it's just not conceivable. It's just not conceivable. That's like already the total losses in the entire Afghanistan campaign of which, you know, Russia withdrew at that time. It just doesn't make sense. Not with the doctrines that they're using, not with their air superiority. That's a huge factor in this, is air superiority. The logistical crisis of the Ukrainian force. You know, you put all these things together and you have to combat this kind of these strange numbers from the Pentagon, which has admitted that they're doing fake news. First of all, they've admitted they're doing fake news. And then they say 40,000 dead. 30,000 dead. You're like, well, that's, so then in your mind, you're instantly going, okay, maybe it's half of that. And you're like, well, 15,000. Wow. You see, because you understand that they're full of shit, but then you just don't realize the scope of tripling down on the full of shitness that they're doing. it seems it kind of you bump the number in your own. You start to bargain against yourself in trying to figure out the number. So now I'm going to leave you with this. Thank you. This one is saved. It'll be on the drive for those who support the work. We just kind of did a rundown of kind of working through. This is a more confined to this conflict. I will come down later in maybe 5 hours and do another stream on a theoretical stuff with the Great Reset. We have more to discuss with understanding the psychology of the ruling class within the context of the film Dark City, which is a dark Gnostic Platonic view of a demiurgic force which has run out of ideas because they are a race that shares a single mind and therefore have entered into a civilizational dead end, and how they are mining for ideas, and how the World Economic Forum is the think tank which is supposed to interact with dissent to come up with a palatable worldview that is supposed to sell to people in the way that only that an alien race that was trying to imitate themes of justice or overcoming systemic inequality or whatever would come up with. Like a weird imitation, like an alien that was trying to imitate a person in the form of a person, but doesn't get any of the details right. And you recognize instantly that person looks weird. Like, are they a burn victim, or why is their complexion so smooth? How come they have zero wrinkles? It would look really weird, right? And that's kind of like the ideology of the World Economic Forum as a weird alien, like what an alien race would try to present back to the public as, this is what social justice looks like. So we're going to talk about that. That'll be in 4 or 5 hours from now. We won't talk about the conflict. This, we just wanted to round up actually what's happening with these 60,000 guys, do a review of the Ukrainian force, what's going on inside their head. We talked about that. And we talked about, is Kharkov actually, has to be some action on that or not? Very good question. We're not committing either way, but the reasons given by Scott Ritter as to why not just don't fly. There may be other reasons why they can avoid that, but it wouldn't be because of the saner heads prevailing on that force of 60,000. So, yes, I want to thank you all for your time. I'm going to be back, and you have a great morning and afternoon. Until then, take care.